wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
The station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The cameras are sawn by a cold by a board, getting broke, getting bored.
Tell me when he's on.
O.J. Simpson abandoned Baden.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's a drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right, and ratings pressures.
News scoop,
what we need to know.
News scoop,
what we want to know.
We got news scoop,
what we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show, but the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows when the spirit.
Did you get the email?
Till freedom is a rumor.
News scoop,
what we need to know.
News scoop,
what we want to know.
We got news scoop,
what we think we know.
Danny Schechter here. Welcome to our weekly media channel program, trying to look at what's in the media, what's coming up in the media, what's being reported well, what's not being reported well, all of the issues that are raised weekly, and sometimes more than one times a week in on mediachannel.org. So the website that, you know, basically has as our slogan, as the media watch the world, we watch the media, mediachannel.org. And joining me now, and I'm very happy to have with me, is David Carr. David Carr is a reporter and a columnist for the New York Times, perhaps one of the most read and respected voices about the media in the media. His column is called The Media Equation, which is, generally speaking, a very substantive and provocative look at media issues. But more than that, you know, David has been reporting on media issues with a certain amount of incisiveness, perhaps because he's come out of alternative media. He worked in Minneapolis. He worked in Washington, D.C., before he joined the mighty MSM, the mainstream media. And so has other experiences to draw on, which is kind of unique among many people who work in mainstream media but have only worked in mainstream media and don't have any other reference points in terms of media culture and analysis, and also has had an incredibly interesting life. I invited David to be on the program after I heard him give a little talk at an awards ceremony at Hunter College, the Aronson Awards, where he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award, maybe kind of young for a Lifetime Achievement Award, but nevertheless, very prescient and very willing to be extremely honest. And one of the things he was asked about was censorship, or spoke to, and said that, you know, the worst censorship in the media is self-censorship. So I wanted to start there. Welcome, David. Do you ever feel any kind of pressure to censor yourself because you're working, you know, in such a mighty organization?
Well, I think it's more like when you come here, whether it's the food in the cafeteria or the air in the elevator, or maybe there's some secret ceremony where they put a chip in you, and when you're not looking, I didn't get here by being super careful, but there's certain things I won't do. I don't swear on Twitter, and I'm generally a fairly profane person. At the time, sometimes we tend to put the jokes between the lines instead of right in the lines, and when we try and call somebody out, we do so based on evidence rather than labels. And it's, I wouldn't call it censorship, I would call it a certain amount of care. Plus, I don't have my hand on the button. I can't say anything that I want. I mean, one of our sort of implicit promises of what we do is that we're a well-edited artifact, so I don't just go popping off. I usually have to fight it through an editor as well.
Well, that was my experience also when I worked at ABC News for 8 years and, you know, was dealing with a lot of layers of people who are providing oversight, some of the positive, actually helping make the stories clearer, make the stories stray on the right side of the law, so you are less likely to be sued, and you're, you know, save the experience of, you know, a gruesome legal process that, you know, even if you win, ends up being debilitating. On the other hand, you're always conscious, or at least I was, you know, of sort of what I thought I could get away with and what I thought I couldn't get away with, and you know, so I was aware of them as well as me. You know, I was part of a news organization as opposed to, and a news culture as opposed to just being, you know, a brilliant voice, you know, that I could fully control.
Yeah, well, you don't want to bring shame on the organization by anything that you do. And there is, you mentioned that I sort of grew up writing in weeklies, and I often stuck out by kind of, you know, letting my butt hang off the surfboard a little farther than some would. But if you wise off about somebody here, you know, you got to be careful, because you could snap their career in half like a dry winter twig. I mean, you have to be conscious of the fact that many people, not all, believe what they write, what we write in the New York Times, and take it as gospel. And you got to make sure you're sure of what you're saying when you say it.
You know, one of the things that intrigued me when I worked at ABC is that, you know, when I would talk to people about, you know, my own, whatever my hobby horse was at the time, you know, responsibility in media, we should be, you know, sensitive to, you know, resisting pressures from corporations and the government and all the rest of it, you know, and the reaction I would sometimes get was, what are you talking about? Nobody takes us seriously. Nobody pays attention, really, to what we're doing. Nobody watches us closely. Maybe a few people, but mostly they don't. And so, you know, we're not, you know, in a sense, scrutinized that closely. We don't have, in fact, we don't even have any influence. We're just out here doing our thing, and if it has an impact, that's good. But you know, it's rare. And then at the same time, then you go to a presentation of the sales department, you know, selling advertisers, and they're saying, you know, we are the most influential media on television. Our surveys show conclusively that we, you know, are, you know, lead to an increase in purchasing decisions and blah, 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 blah. We are very powerful. So is it power or not? You know, how do people inside perceive their influence?
Well, when I mean, I've been covering Comcast a lot, and they're a big company, and they're fairly wired up in Washington, but I know they care about what I write. It's not dispositive. It isn't the only thing, but they care about what I say. The big media companies that I cover, Time Warner, whoever it is, they take the time to respond, and it's not because my last name is Carr, it's because my last name is New York Times.
So you have to be conscious of having a lot of influence, in a sense, because, you know, the media page of the New York Times, your column, you know, is something that helps shape the way we look at some of these issues and what we know about them. In my experience, a lot of people who are not on the inside of media don't know very much about how decisions are made or the impact of the decisions that have been made. In other words, we think that power is in Congress. Power is in the White House. Power is in politics. They don't have a sense that power is also in the way stories are framed or not.
Yeah, anybody who thinks power only belongs to elected officials probably never met Rupert Murdoch. So, I mean, there's, you know, how powerful is Roger Ailes? He makes $1 billion for Fox every year through Fox News. I mean, it could be argued that the Fox News support of the Tea Party played a fundamental role in the last election. They employed 6 people that eventually end up running for president one way or another. So there are all kinds of power, and that's one of them. I mean, Rachel Maddow is a very important, powerful person. Things she says matters. What the New Yorker says matters. What the Wall Street Journal says matters.
I guess when you're working in television and there's just, you're kind of what we call feeding the maw, you know, we're constantly pumping out news stories, and often these stories tend to get homogenized, so one looks like the next and feels like the next in some ways. I think you have less of a sense of great mission and importance. You feel like you are, in a way, you know, in the entertainment business.
Yeah, I don't think anything has done more to shape contemporary political discourse than television. I might think when I type I'm doing things really important, but there's sort of television and everything else. And, you know, if 60 Minutes turns the guns on a story, it can tilt the rink. The demographic of the evening news may have aged and gotten smaller, but it still matters a lot what Brian Williams says, and then there's a whole cable news apparatus around that to pick it apart. I mean, if I happen to show up on CNN, which I haven't done for a while, I hear from people. And the other thing is the whole public media. I mean, probably, I don't know, a couple times a year I end up on Charlie Rose, and some people think that that's my job when I'm on Charlie Rose. My father was a person who loved that I was a journalist and loved that I wrote, but he really only paid attention when I showed up on television. And I find myself, he passed away last year, I find myself doing a lot less television, because mostly what I was thinking about when I said yes to coming on TV was that it would make my dad happy.
It would make him proud of his son.
That I was real, that I really did something, because there I was on his television set.
You know, but David, thinking about just, you know, listening, I really didn't know your story. I still don't know it fully, but, you know, you spoke at this awards ceremony as someone who had been on welfare, as someone who had been, if not a addict, a cocaine addict, somebody who knew about drugs because you were part of the drug culture. And I think that's given you a tremendous amount of sensitivity, not only to the abuses of the police, but also, you know, to the kind of addictions that people have. So you can approach, you know, issues based on your own biography, your own life experience, that gives you a certain amount of sensitivity. And I'm not slathering you, by the way, in saying all this. I'm admiring the fact that you can bring that background, but I think very few people do have that kind of background. You know, we have a much more cookie cutter group of people who've gone to journalism school, they worked in politics, then they move on into the media, and they have, even if they're Democrats or Republicans, they seem to have one point of view about, you know, power. We have it, and the rest of the people don't.
Yeah, I think what having a textured life will do is make you slower to judgment. I mean, people always talk about, you know, welfare moms feeding off the public trough. Well, it'd be like, give that a whirl for a week. See how much fun that is. You try living with $3 until Tuesday and see what that feels like. You try and push a stroller down the street that's got a broken wheel. You try and then get that stroller and your 3-year-old onto a bus with snowsuits that don't zip. It's not exactly Disneyland. It's not the funnest thing in the world. I was a single parent, and for sure it was the hardest thing I ever did.
But, you know, you were able to, shall we say, balance, you know, your family and your working life and find some way of putting the two together. It's not always very easy, particularly when you feel some sort of dedication, particularly to what you're doing. It's not just, you know, one story doesn't seem to be like in every other one to you. I mean, you seem to really take time to get a real read on it. And you use the word feeling. You know, I mean, this is something that's missing in a lot of the media, in my experience. People having feelings, or expecting the audience or the readers or the viewers to have feelings.
Yeah, I mean, to the issue of work-life balance, I certainly made a ton of mistakes. I have one daughter who ran varsity cross country in high school, and her meets were at 4:00 in the afternoon. They were way out in Jersey, and I never saw her run, and it was her last race, and I barely knew where to stand or where to look, and all of a sudden a herd of young women cross-country runners came flying over the hill, and my kid was, like, at the front of the pack, and I burst out bawling, mostly because of sort of what I had missed. I mean, I was so proud of her. She's born 2.5 months premature. She didn't have much for lungs when she was born. Here she was. You know, she set a county record that day. It was an amazing thing, and it was great to be there, but I thought a lot about how much I had missed because I was, you know, in the city working on my little plot to take over the world, so I would not hold myself out as an example of work life balance in any regard.
Well, you know, who holds themselves out that way? I mean, we are all very, very deeply aware of our own limitations and problems that we have. In fact, there's an article about you and your girls that you wrote that's, you know, online, you know, under David Carr. You know, you can Google and read, and it's very touching and also, you know, made me think also, because I have a daughter too, about, you know, only had one to try to raise, you know, but, you know, it's very challenging, and it took a lot, I think, to do it and give you a kind of humanity that, you know, sometimes people who are in professional roles fight that in themselves. They fight, you know, their own vulnerabilities. They try to pretend they're so much smarter than they often are. They don't ask questions that really get more deeply into things. It becomes, you know, much easier to sort of go with whatever the dominant narrative is.
Yeah, I never have been that guy, and I don't know why anybody would. I think you have to be in the moment and be conscious of what the possibilities are. And the minute you think, oh, I'm just making commodity journalism and who's going to really notice, it's over. You might as well just give it up. You have to, every time you step up, believe that you're doing important stuff. And maybe it's a lie we tell ourselves, but you have to be willing to try and make it better. And like I say at the New York Times, just in case you aren't trying hard enough, you've always got somebody here to say, you know what, I think that could be better. I think you haven't really thought this through. I mean, these are standards that we hold in common here.
So, you know, so there is obviously a culture of, say, criticism, self-criticism to some degree, but there's also a sense of, you know, I feel, maybe because I'm on the outside, a kind of pretension about we have the truth and the rest of you don't. We are all the news that fit the print. You know, a kind of arrogance about certain subjects and people who have studied the Times, I'm not talking about your column, but have studied coverage of major issues, have found a lot to complain about in terms of what's left out, questions not asked, deeper investigations not encouraged, and the rest of it. And that there's a, you know, I think a tension there about how to cope with it. I mean, we were just at this conference at the New York Times on you know, the surveillance issues and James Risen's problems, and the paper sort of held up in reporting his story, you know, for almost a year before they finally did so. So, you know, it's not, in saying all this, it doesn't demean the New York Times. What I'm saying is a challenging place to be, you know, kind of the guys at the top.
Yeah, I mean, if you're accusing the Times of institutional arrogance, I think everyone could agree that there's been times when the place has felt a stronger belief in what they're saying than maybe it should have. And if you're talking about was the place always well served by that arrogance? I think certainly not on the run up to the war in Iraq. Certainly not. Well, Jason Blair was doing his work here. But you have to realize, like, if you look at sort of our pre-war reporting, well, I think we are very straightforward in patting ourselves down after that, and we're the ones who stayed in Baghdad. My best friend at the paper is in the Baghdad Bureau of the New York Times right now, still reporting, still telling that story. It's not that we are perfect and not that we sometimes fall short of our arrogant beliefs in ourselves. We stay put, and we're pretty dedicated in terms of what we do. And, you know, overall, I do think that sometimes when I'm traveling and I haven't been at the paper for a while, the paper pops out, and I'm just stunned by it. And I think it's one of humankind's greatest creations. I mean, you mentioned Jim Risen's book and the fact that it didn't fall right into the paper. His earlier work on NSA. We did fund, edit, and eventually publish that story, and there was tremendous government resistance to what we were doing. I think we've been fairly aggressive in following up on some of the revelations that came out of Edward Snowden. I think we've acquitted ourselves very nicely, but I'm not one of these people who thinks Mother Times is perfect in all regards.
But there is a public editor, actually, who how do you think she's doing? I mean, I think that's a tough job, to criticize your colleagues, to look critically and analytically at the coverage. And she's raised quite a few issues that I think, what happens? Do people take it seriously, or is it just considered one more feature in the paper?
Well, number one, Margaret is not our colleague. She's employed by Arthur Sulzberger, and her contract is with the publisher. So we're not colleagues in the clinical sense. I think it matters a lot, like, who's doing the job. She's a former editor of Buffalo News, is a very good writer, also good at social media, also good at sort of what's a news story, what's not. And I would say people here take her fairly seriously, because when you're dealing with her, you're dealing with, forgive me, a newsman. You know, you can tell. And people may not agree with everything that Margaret says or does. I know I don't, but yeah, I think her stuff is taken fairly seriously. And I'm glad, because, you know, there's not that many public editors at American Papers anymore. It's sort of the first thing to go, and the Washington Post is dumping theirs, and you know, so I think it matters, and I think she acquits the job very well. I don't know that everybody in that job has always done as good a job as she has.
You wrote a column the other day on V. Stiviano and this whole Sterling, L.A. Clippers, tape recording, racism, whatever the story is. And you, in the headline at least, says V. Stiviano feeds the media's appetite. What is the, can we speak of a media appetite? Do you feel like there's a kind of a group of stories, like one week it's V. Stiviano, the next week it's the Nigerian girls who are missing? I mean, is there one issue that sort of the whole press corps rallies around?
Well, I mean, in the instance of V. Stiviano, you got race, sex, money, pro sports, you got the most hated team owner in sports. That thing sort of had it all, and engaged both traditional and non-traditional media. And, you know, he got put into the spanking machine, and, you know, it just wouldn't let up, a lot of billions at stake. And I just was trying to suggest that every once in a while a story comes along that hits every button, and that was probably one of them.
Probably best. Carr, C-A-R-R, at nytimes.com. Ping me, and I'll return your call. Thanks so much. Hope you're happy.
Okay. Now, well, I don't know if you're still with us, David.
I am. I'm still here.
Okay, no problem. We heard that message. It sounded important. Anyway, here's the key thing that I'm trying to get you to help me understand. You know, there's a lot of us out here who are very angry with the media, certainly on the left and certainly on the far right, even though the far right seems to have a lot more media going for them than people who are considering themselves progressives. Is the media our enemy, or do you feel like our attitude is maybe wrong to see the media that way. You know, and of course, when you say the media, you know, it's a big statement about a lot of different types of media. But you know what I'm saying? In other words, media has become a sort of an issue and a target in a way that it never maybe was before.
Well, if you look at public opinion surveys, people view us as lower than a snake's belly. So, I mean, it's not like we're the most popular people in the world. When I'm on airplanes, which is fairly frequently, I don't usually bring up what I do because I don't want to sit through a big speech about what's wrong with the media or what's wrong with the New York Times. I don't think it really... I mean, I think media coverage in general right now is better than it's ever been. There's countless sources of it. You know, you have Twitter and social media. You have radio, both terrestrial, satellite, and web-borne radio. You have great big media organizations doing blogs. You have blogs that have grown up into big news organizations like BuzzFeed and Gawker that are actually hiring reporters. And I don't think, as you know, I think you pointed out yourself, Danny, there just isn't really a monolith to attack anymore. And that one of the great things and one of the problems of the current state of the media is that if you don't like what one person is saying, you can always go on to the other. The problem is that people self-assemble into verticals of interest that sort of comport with their politics, and you end up dealing with confirmation bias. I still get people calling me that think, it was a government plot to take down the Twin Towers. And when you say, well, that manifestly is not true, they say, well, it's on the Internet. It must be true. You know, it's like, well, you can find whatever you want out there, but I share your opinion.
Well, let me just say that I'm happy to be able to find your voice in the New York Times, and I think so are a lot of other people. What are you working on something now that goes beyond the daily? Are you writing a book? Are you doing something that we should look for?
I'm working on a great big heave for the New York Times, and it's a super secret project, but it's sort of in line with a couple years ago, some guys took over the Tribune Company, and they ruined a lot of good newspapers and ruined a lot of employees' lives. And so I'm kind of inching a project along the margins that way. And no, I'm not writing a book. I'm no threat to write a book right now. Writing a book I found to be exhausting and terrible is how I describe it. I mean, I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad I have a book and was well received, and it helped put my kids through college. But I'm going to start teaching at Boston University one day a week next year and get involved in the education of young journalists. Still keep my job at the New York Times. But that's sort of, in lieu of writing a book, that's something I'm going to do.
Well, thank you so much for connecting with us on Media Channel Radio. David Carr, the columnist of the Media Equation column in the New York Times, a reporter for the media section, a writer. I would call you a sort of a humanist or certainly a person with multiple perspectives on life, and somebody who's not afraid to talk about himself and his own history in a very honest and open way. So thank you, David, for joining us here. And I'm sure that your writing will continue to be very influential in the media.
Oh, it's a deep pleasure to talk with you, Danny, and your audience as well. Hope everybody has a grand day. See you later.
Okay, and now we're going to move on to Nigeria and the story that the world is talking about the kidnapped girls there in a minute. But we wanted to play a little music from Sonny Okosin, who is one of the Nigerian musicians who I know and respect. He was on our Sun City album Against Apartheid years ago, and this is a song called Which Way Nigeria.
I want to know
which way Nigeria is
way to go.
I love my fatherland.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know.
Okay, we're back. Media Channel Radio. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. Our guest is now going to talk to us about the coverage, her perspective on the coverage of the campaign to bring back the girls who have been kidnapped in Nigeria. Her name, Margaret Kimberly. Margaret is a blogger and a writer and an editor and a senior columnist of the Black Agenda Report, news commentary and analysis from the Black Left. I find her work extremely well done, provocative and to the point, and often outspoken in a way that we rarely read in our media, particularly of perspectives about the Black world and Black issues. Her column is called Freedom Rider, and the headline, How Not to Bring Back Our Girls. And part of it is a critique of the media coverage. So welcome, Margaret.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Definitely. And I'm, you know, you're a great writer. You're fascinating. What is your take on this whole story right now? Obviously, it's an ongoing story.
Right. Well, the problem is these events that seem to be singular never are. Unfortunately, and I'm not judging people because they don't know a lot about Africa in general or Nigeria in particular.
You
hear about something, an outrage like this, like these children who were taking exams, who were kidnapped and taken away from their families, and the reaction is, if you're at all a decent ethical person, is to be upset, to be saddened, and to wonder what you can do. But that's a problem when people never heard of Boko Haram until a week ago, don't know that this is an ongoing, you could say it's reached the point of a civil war in Nigeria, when you don't know that the Nigerian government, Nigerian police, kidnapped relatives of Boko Haram members in an effort to punish them or get them to turn themselves in. And the response, this is 2 years ago, was, well, if you snatch our people, we're going to snatch yours. And that's when these kidnappings began of students in these schools in remote locations.
Well, you know, Margaret, they say, you know, all politics is local.
Yes.
Okay. And if you don't really know the context and the background, you tend to form a very simplistic view.
Yes.
And at the same time, this seems to be a very compelling story because, you know, young girls kidnapped. You know, I have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Obama just spoke out on this. Everybody seems to be either speaking out on it or hashtagging it.
Right.
In Twitter, it's become, you know, the CNN story of the week with endless coverage. But what are we learning about this particular crisis or the issues in Africa?
Well, we don't know anything. If you follow the corporate media, which had ignored the existence of Boko Haram until very recently, which hasn't told us anything about it, and doesn't explain to us how politics work in countries like Nigeria, which are very weak structurally, a failed state, if you will. It's an oil-rich nation, which is frankly more of a problem for the average Nigerian than a benefit. The government exists to keep this resource flowing, to keep the Americans and the Europeans happy with this supply of their resource, which has caused great ecological damage to Nigeria, a great deal of corruption. So that's what the government does, and it's a fairly large country. It's not small. Most African countries have poor communication and poor transportation networks, so the northern part of the country may as well be the other side of the moon. And so the government, and it frankly is inept when they're not sure if kids were kidnapped or first say they were taken and then say they weren't and then claim they were recovered. And so you have this failed state which exists to keep their elites enriched, which exists to keep oil flowing to the capitalist West. So when you have a group like Boko Haram, which takes an action like this, they're really, despite the fact that they have a military, they're powerless to do anything to stop it. There's also the news stories lack any analysis about the different regions in Nigeria, and you know, colonialism creates these phony states, if you will, where there is a mostly Islamic north, which had its own educational system and its own culture, but it's all the colonizer makes this country, quote unquote, where people have different languages and religions and customs, and when there is so much corruption and poverty, corruption, a bad education system, then of course you have all the ingredients for an insurgency like this. And I certainly don't mean to defend what they've done to these kids. But that is what people need to know about Nigeria. And people also need to know that hashtags and petitions are not policy. And people like to think, and it's understandable, that they can have some influence, especially when there's a story like this, which people feel so strongly about, and rightly so. But there really is nothing the average American can do to help this situation, except to waste their time, frankly, and not knowing what it is that has created this crisis, created this situation. People, the outrage is just—it's more confusion than anything else, and it's not at all helpful.
Well,
so,
Margaret, I'd like to—I don't know why we're getting reverb here, but I would like to get back to what we can do about it. But
right.
One of the first things about doing anything about anything is knowing something about it. Okay.
Correct.
And one of the things you point out in your column here on Black Agenda Report, you quote the Tyndall Report. This is Andrew Tyndall,
mm-hmm.
a friend of mine who's been monitoring the media for years,
mm-hmm.
and note that the broadcasts of the three major U.S. networks
mm-hmm.
in all of 2013,
mm-hmm.
all of them didn't have one report on this situation in Nigeria that's been going on for years.
Right. And that speaks to the corporate media who, you know, have retrenched over the years. They used to have stations all over the world. They had offices in various parts of the world, and now they've closed them down so they don't disseminate information as well as they ought to. And then, of course, there's the issue of even if they do, what do they tell people? So I've read over and over again that Boko Haram, haram meaning forbidden by Islamic law, that Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. But actually, that's not true. It's the translation roughly is Western corruption is forbidden. You know, many of these girls were Muslim, so people start to then form conclusions based on misinformation. Muslims don't want women to be educated. And the issue is more about Western influence in that country, which destroyed much of Nigeria's culture. So even if they do cover it, they don't get the facts. Even if they do cover it, they don't talk about AFRICOM, the Africa Command, which puts Nigerian military under the command of the United States to benefit who? The United States. It's to make sure the resources keep flowing. It's to prevent African countries from forming relationships with nations who could benefit them, where they could have a mutually beneficial relationship,
like
China.
In this case, however, I mean, we do have a situation where the impulse to intervene, U.S.
Mm-hmm.
government, do something, send
right.
troops, do... Really, those troops arrive, but they don't leave. You know
exactly. This is not a good thing to have American interventions anywhere in the world. The United States does not bring anything beneficial, even if they are interested in putting troops on the ground. It's not clear how that would help these girls be found safely. I mean, they haven't been discovered because they've been spirited away.
I don't know if you know about this, but, you know, there is in New York and a company called Sahara Reporters that does a program every week on Nigeria, from New York, for Nigeria, on YouTube, Sahara Reporters. You can check it out.
Okay, thank you.
With a lot of voices from Nigeria. On our mediachannel.org, we have an interview with the organizer and leader, a Nigerian human rights activist who actually organized Sahara Reporters. You know, their subhead is, you know, all things African.
Mm-hmm.
He was recently on Amy Goodman's show, but you know, they're not. Here is a subject that they've been covering every week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yet when journalists like CNN and others come to cover it, they don't go to them because
no.
They might know something about it. Okay, so I mean, this is something that we have to be aware of. You know, that there is a horrible, obvious human rights issue here,
mm-hmm.
but it's one of many. And one of the things
yes.
that they reported on Sahara Reporters is that actually the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, the biggest Occupy protests in the world took place in Nigeria. Occupy Nigeria, and they rolled back an attempt to raise the price of petrol in the country. It was a mass mobilization of Nigerians. It got virtually no coverage here. Sahara Reporters did a great documentary about it. I talked on mediachannel.org about it with their founder, Samwori, who really is a very smart and very passionate person. But, you know, here's something that can happen in the world. We're focused on Occupy. We care about it, those of us who do. And yet there's an Occupy Nigeria. We know nothing about it.
Right. Correct. Absolutely. And so when people depend on the corporate media, even, you know, I've said many times, if you read the New York Times every day, you still wouldn't know what you needed, everything you needed to know about the world. And then you have these outlets, and thank God they exist. We have Black Agenda Report or Sahara Reporters, the Or Show, many others I could name, but we're not the ones with the biggest reach. And people respond to the story of the abduction of the schoolgirls depending on people who give them misinformation. And the other problem is Americans tend to think that their country is the best. We don't think about the human rights abuses that happen in the country. The worst human rights abuse in this country is the prison system, which is worse than any other country in the world. But we insist that our military go and intervene to help these kids, because America will get it right. And there's no proof of that, no proof of that whatsoever. And they're also, I mean, there's so much, as you know, I like to say, so much evil, so little time. There's so many things people can pay attention to. I wouldn't tell people not to pay attention to this story. But we also need to keep in mind, when the United States is involved in African governments, we have backed some of the worst, most brutal leaders in the world. In Uganda, President Museveni, and Kagame in Rwanda, invading Eastern Congo, and killing 6 million people. Kagame, the Rwandan military, kidnaps children and forces them into the military. The same thing in Uganda. So these are countries, these are our leaders who would not be in power, who get weapons and money from our country, who do the same thing as Boko Haram has done in Nigeria, and people aren't even aware of it. So we'll focus on this, and I'm going to repeat, I'm not saying people shouldn't, but I think it's useful for people to know that the United States has not been a force for good in that continent.
Can you open her mic? So, Margaret, just by chance, we have a young woman with us in the studio who's here in New York working with Global Vision on a television project, who comes from South Africa, young journalist Kim Harrisberg, who's just traveled in East Africa and is also very concerned about this situation in Nigeria. Do you have any thoughts about this, Kim, that you'd like to share?
Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Well, just on your comment in terms of what the public's role can be, I mean, if people, you know, they're relying on the media for the information, they might feel slightly debilitated or helpless, and maybe, you know, the hashtags and things like that as maybe they might not be as effective as they would like them to be, but it's the next best thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that because, you know, if you're not a journalist or if you're relying on people to give you information but they're not giving you as much as they should, what do you advise the people to do then? Because, you know, in today's age, like, a hashtag is sometimes quite a vocal form of protest. In a strange way.
It can be. That's true. I mean, I, you know, use social media, use Twitter and Facebook to get the word out about my writing and Black Agenda Report. But I think there's several lessons that can be learned. One, the singular event generally is not. There's always a bigger story and a longer history, and it would help if people, even if they don't know that the particulars of that history themselves, that there is always something more to a story. Two, asking for U.S. Military intervention is never helpful to anybody, because three, the United States is the worst destabilizing force in the world right now. And four, I'm not saying Americans can't be concerned about human rights abuses abroad, but I do believe it's helpful to start at home, because then we stop thinking that America is the answer to help people around the world who are facing such serious crises. So I think those are a few things people should keep in mind, and know that what we can do are things that it's not what we think. You know, people want to write a check or send a tweet. But it seems clear to me what Nigeria needs to do is talk to Boko Haram. They need to be negotiating with one another. So if Americans are going to advocate for anything, it should be advocating with the president. I mean, the United States still holds sway in the world. Nigeria needs to negotiate with this group, which they clearly are unable to subdue, and at great risk, at great suffering to people in that country. Boko Haram have killed more than 1,000 people in the past year. So has the Nigerian military killed a lot of people too. So it's a bit problematic. And then of course when you're emotionally involved in a story that you don't know much about, and it becomes good people and bad people, well, the Nigerian government is not good. So those are the things that people can do that are really more helpful. I would say it's far more important to educate yourself and to look outside of the corporate media for information.
Yes.
And for advocacy.
Okay, so there's a strong sense of agency that comes with the public at large, that they have to, I mean, like you said, Boko Haram doesn't mean what everyone thinks it means, and that just
right.
took you maybe asking a Nigerian or doing your own research to find that out for yourself.
Yes, I happen to tell people on Facebook that this is what I was going to write about this week, and I started to get this very helpful information from others.
Yes.
Margaret, could I just, since we're doing a media program,
sure.
can you tell us a little bit about how you began to blog and got into the media? I mean, you're a very good writer.
Oh, thank you so much. It all started about 10 years ago, and I discovered a site called Black Commentator, which still exists. And Glenn Ford, our executive editor at Black Agenda Report, was at Black Commentator, and I really enjoyed the work that I read at Black Commentator. And I wanted to write an op-ed, and I emailed Glenn. That's the beauty of the Internet. You know, anybody who wants to start writing can. So they did print it, and then we talked about me, you know, writing on a regular basis, which is can be hard to do, to write something every single week, although it's been a great training ground for me. And then we, Glenn and Bruce Dixon and I, formed Black Agenda Report back in 2006, and have continued doing what we've been doing. But I would just say, you know, the beauty of social media and blogging is for everybody to just start. You become a good writer by writing a lot. There are numerous sites, numerous groups that people can affiliate themselves with, And so I would just, it's a perfect time to just get started and write about what you want to write about.
Well, on Media Channel, we're writing about the media because we see it as a very powerful and often not a very accountable power center in American life, dominated by big corporations, framing issues for the rest of us, featuring commentary by people who basically support the status quo, marginalizing people who don't. So media itself is an issue, but it's not treated as an issue.
It is. It is. And we have a media, you know, the media that reaches the vast bulk of the population is corporate controlled, and that's very, very problematic. But we, you know, thank goodness that we now have these tools that enable everyone to express their point of view, perhaps to a smaller audience, but still to do so. And I think it's important to keep in mind that you know, the repetition and sticking with it means that you do find an audience. So we have an audience at Black Agenda Report. You have an audience. There are many other people who do great stuff, who also find an audience too. So I would say let's, you know, go with what we have. There are many good groups. There's still old-fashioned organizing going on. Black Agenda Report is affiliated with other groups like the Black Is Back Coalition or UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. I urge people to, it may seem old-fashioned, but, you know, Occupy, which did not succeed at first, I'm not one who says it failed completely, was huge all across the country. There were Occupy, it started at Wall Street, but there's an Occupy for, you know, every major city and some small towns all across the country. And
definitely can. Media can definitely ignite, give ideas, inspire mm-hmm. action, and galvanize people to get involved in things. One of the things that we did have in America for a long time was a very vital Black press. And that seems to have been diminished. I mean, this week, Jet Magazine reported that it's going to be an online publication instead of a print publication that's succumbing to the same pressures that a lot of other print media has succumbed to. Do you feel that this is something that we're missing in America, more of a platform for Black voices?
Well, yeah, you know, what you just talked about with the print media, I mean, you know, major newspapers, their readership has, and magazines, you know, we all grew up reading are now online only. There are major cities that don't have a print newspaper anymore, so obviously those pressures would affect the Black press as well. But there are people coming online like us, yourblackworld.net, I hope it's not .net, I'm getting it right. Excuse me, but there are people doing great stuff with this new medium.
Well, your editor, Glenn Ford, is very gutsy. I mean, he's not one of these people who's just sort of writes what's expected. I mean, he's a real critic of Barack Obama, for example.
Oh, we are, yes,
consistently,
absolutely.
And feel that, you know, that we're on the wrong track here, and that a lot of people sort of drank the Kool-Aid and bought the hype.
Well, yeah, we, you know, as we say, as you said, we say news and commentary from the Black left perspective, and we are on the left, quite proudly so. We see the failure of the implosion, really, of our system. The, you know, people act like there's going to be some big collapse of our society, our economy, and our political life, but it's a process, and we're already in it. We're seeing it. And the Democratic Party is part of the problem. Not only is it not going to help us, but is part of the problem. So we have to look at new ways. We have to question. We can't just say, you have to keep voting for the Democrats, you have no choice. We can't just say, isn't it wonderful there's a Black man in the White House, when in order to get to the White House, he does the same thing that white men do to get to the White House, namely curry favor with wealthy individuals and big corporations and do what benefits them.
Well, Margaret, I mean, there's a lot more to be said, and fortunately you have an outlet to say it in. Every week, a Black Agenda Report online. Do check it out. Thank you for joining us today to talk about this very vexing problem, Bring Back Our Girls, the story of the kidnapped children in Nigeria and the worldwide concern about it. At the same time, you're cautioning us, try to understand more deeply about what's happening in that country. It's not just a new phenomena, and it's not going to be just transformed by a Twitter hashtag. So I think you've made that point very clearly. Thank you again being on our mediachannel.org radio. This will be in print on mediachannel.org too, so join us there. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Another show. Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report, earlier David Carr of the New York Times, two very different voices and two very different situations in our media verse, in our media world, but with a lot to say and a lot of interesting questions to raise about the media. So we want to thank you for joining us. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Any comments and suggestions for guests or questions that you want to raise, please do that. Thank you. Progressive Radio Network as well for having us on. We're going to go out with a little more of that song, Which Way, Nigeria, Sunny Okosan.